This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So I thought we could talk a little bit about what it means not to be us and see if we can figure out, you know, why we aren't who we think we are and to see if we should be anybody in particular after all. So one of the sutras that I really like is the Heart Sutra, and you find this in the Mahayana tradition, and it's called the Mahaprajnaparamita Heart Sutra. And this is like the Wisdom Sutra. This is the heart of the ultimate reality we find in Mahayana Buddhism. This is where it really gets cool and abstract, and it's difficult to understand. And I tell you, I struggled with this sutra for a really long time. Even after I memorized it and would repeat it over and over again, it still made little or no sense at all. Because I knew I was somebody. Everybody told me I was. And they even recognized me. And they called me by name. And so how could I not exist in the way they thought I did? Then I read the Heart Sutra, and I'm just going to read a little bit of it, not the whole thing, though it's very short anyway. But it goes like this: Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the perfect wisdom, clearly saw that all five skandhas are empty and pass beyond all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form then is emptiness. Emptiness then is form, sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness are also like this. Okay, now that's how it starts, you know, and it doesn't get any easier as you continue. And so I'm thinking, okay, form and emptiness. I understand what form is, but what the heck is emptiness? And is it like empty in the sense of a glass is half empty? Is it like empty in the sense of my pocket has no change? Is that the kind of empty they're talking about? So I struggle with it. And as it turns out, that's not the kind of emptiness they're talking about. And the form they're talking about is one of the five aggregates. Now, the five aggregates is found in early Buddhism. And it's an important distinction of... It's used oftentimes to describe what a human being really is. And when the Buddha talked about humans, he never said they were simply one thing. He said they were always two things or more. And I couldn't figure out initially why he had a problem with one. Now, if we look back to the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition, we have the one God and we have monotheism. And it really sort of ends up everything being one. And I always had a difficulty with everything being one because I never felt like I was part of the one, which perhaps is why I became a Buddhist. And in Buddhism, we're a part of the many. Nothing ever turns out to be ultimately one. It turns out ultimately to be many that are connected, which gives us a chance at diversity and being who we need to be instead of being who we should be. So, if that's the case, and if humans aren't one, the five aggregates help us to define humans as being form, sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness. Those are the five aggregates, one of them being form. And when he was talking about the form aspect, he actually meant form. We have the form of the eye, the form of the ear, the form of the body, the form of the nose, the form of the mouth. So we can see and we can hear and we can smell and we can taste and we can touch. And those form objects come in contact with other form objects in the world. So the eye form comes in contact with the bottle form, and consciousness is there to receive it. This is a really rudimentary form of consciousness. This is an advanced consciousness. It doesn't think. It doesn't conceptualize. It's just sort of there, responding to the world around it. What really stimulates the consciousness for us, though, is our like or dislike of it. That starts us going. So we're either attracted to it or we have aversion towards it. Now, in order to have aversion and attraction, we really need to name it as well. We need to understand what we're looking at or hearing or smelling or tasting or touching. So we have this perception stuff going on. And I thought to myself, well, why do I perceive things in the way I do? And I was at the old Bodhi Tree bookstore in Melrose back in the 1980s, and there was this book on the shelf that was all dog-eared and highlighted and half-price in the used bookstore. And somehow my hand found it, and I said to myself, this is exactly what I've been looking for, because this will help me understand what the heck these aggregates are and perception and consciousness. And it was called The Spectrum of Consciousness. It was written by Ken Wilber. And it was one of the first books he ever wrote. And it took him a long time to get it published. And finally, the Unitarians published it. And Ken Wilber is probably the first one to say he doesn't really like this book very much. It's a little bit romantic, and it's not as precise as it could be. But it was perfect for me because I'm rather romantic and not very precise. And what he talked about is he talked about the wisdom of the world and the great authors and thinkers and spiritual folks and how they came to understand the relative reality and the ultimate reality of what it meant to be a human being. And there was another book called Perennial Philosophy, written by Aldous Huxley, that predated Spectrum of Consciousness. And if it's still being published, I can highly recommend it because it's really fun to read the spirituality and the higher consciousness of the world in one book, Perennial Philosophy. So Ken Wilber went on to describe that, you know, in the beginning we are trying to be somebody. We are being formed by our parents and by our kindergarten, by our grade schools and high schools, eventually by our bosses and our spouses, and we're just being formed all the time. We're continually in the process of becoming somebody, but unfortunately, according to Buddhism, we never attain that somebody-ness. It's a process of becoming, but that process doesn't end. So I thought to myself, okay, well, who was I in kindergarten? And I thought back to my first day in kindergarten, and that's when I really, that was the first time I didn't like my mom. Because she was a wonderful human being up until then. And then one day she puts me in the car, and we drive to this giant building with windows and doors, and there's a bunch of people that look just like me who I don't know. And she drops me off, and then she leaves. I didn't have mom anymore. And I had this teacher who was supposed to be a mom surrogate, but not very good. And then all these people that I didn't know and I didn't like, and they didn't like me. And I started to go through this whole process of socialization now, having to become somebody in order to interact and be with others. Because I came from a secluded environment. It was dad, and it was mom, and it was me and my sister. You know, that was my world. And now we have all these other people. Some of these little guys could even read. I'm thinking, read already? You know, so I continued to go to kindergarten because I had to, and we had nap time. And we had this, we had a thin blanket that we put on the floor, and then we laid down on that. And I hated to take naps. And I must be honest with you, today I love to take naps. I took one today. It's wonderful when you get older to take a nap. It's also a great way to lose weight because it takes the place of a meal. You know, it rejuvenates you with no calories at all. So then grade school, and I started to learn about words, and I saw how words were applied to things that had nothing to do with the word. And I thought to myself now, in reflection, how interesting is that, that the word chair has nothing at all to do with a chair. It's a sound that we create, and we point at something, and everybody goes, oh, that's a chair. So we sort of in conspiracy with each other to name something. You know? And that's how we can communicate. So we don't have to say the chair has legs and a back and a seat and sometimes arms and sometimes not. We can simply say chair. And that one word allows us to form this picture in our head. And each of us have our own special chair that we like to think about when somebody says chair. Now, if we're talking about another language, I have a German friend, and she said, do you know what Lawine is? I said, no. And she said, well, if you're ever in the mountains and they start yelling Lawine, run like hell, because that means avalanche. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting how some people would know to run and other people would just sort of look around, you know? And so how words are the building blocks of our reality and the story of our life. And the more words we have, the more complex our story can be. And we can hardly wait to share our story with others and include them in our story. As friends or foe, we can become victor or victims. It's one, and the mind just sort of does this all by itself, all the time, sleeping and waking. That we have the internal dialogue, we also have the dream state. A little more subconscious stuff going on. But still the story is being written. It's rare that it ever stops being written. And people often ask me, well, when you meditate, do you think? Can't you stop your thought process? And you really can't. It's going to continue whether you want it to or not, because that's its job. Its job is to think about you and keep you alive. Its job is also to give you an identity, so you're able to relate with others. And that's the problem with one. If we're all one, then we can't even talk to each other. You know? We can't leave the room because we don't know the door is there. Being one with everything is sort of a bummer. So we need to be separate, and our mind is constantly creating separateness for us. Now and then in our meditation, though, we can find a little bit of silence. And what I look at, I look at it this way, that I'm sitting in this large room and I have this TV set on over here and I have the radio on over here and I'm reading this book. And if I read the book hard enough with enough focus and mindfulness, I can't hear the TV or the radio, though it's still playing, of course. And that's how I look at my meditation. If I'm really focused on the object of my meditation, which is my breath, then that discursive thought that's in the background sort of falls away. But it's still ongoing. It's just I'm not aware of it in the same way I was before. So we don't really want to kill that part of our mind that defines us and creates the world for us. They call that Alzheimer's. And so we want to shy away from that. We want to be able to incorporate that and use it to our advantage like a tool, but at certain times not have to be it. So if our discursive thought goes into anger and hatred, lust or greed, delusion or ignorance, we may speak and act unskillfully and create more suffering for ourselves and others. If we're aware of a discursive thought, maybe we can have a choice in whether it manifests in speech or action, or it doesn't. But if we're not aware of it, it's going to manifest because that's the nature of intention to bring speech and action into the world. So I'm reading this book, and I'm reading this book, and it's starting to make sense. There's like ladders of consciousness, and at one point it said, you know, if you're having a problem with your girlfriend or your boyfriend, probably the best thing to do is go to a counselor, because if you take a spiritual approach, a meditative approach, a yogic approach, it may take 20 years to resolve those issues. So these are psychotechnologies that we can use to expedite the process of coming back into balance, of being normal. Now, I'm not sure what that is anymore. I used to know what normal was. You know, but then I got a ukulele and I just, it was all over for me. There was an actress named Frances Farmer. Does anybody remember her? And there was a movie called Frances. And they considered her not to be normal. And they put her in a mental institution. And she was just a rascal, that's all. She was fine, but nobody wanted her to be the way she was. They wanted her to sort of be like everybody else. And if you go online to YouTube, you can see Ralph Edwards' This Is Your Life, Frances Farmer, 1958. It will trip you out if you know the story of Frances, because Frances says, I never felt there was anything wrong with me. And everybody in her life felt there was. So what does it mean to be you, and what does it mean to be normal? And can we be ourselves and be a little unnormal? And that's when I started to listen to Ram Dass, and I started to appreciate what he had to say. And he kept talking about nobody training, going into nobody training. And I'm going, wow, I've been reading about somebody training and why we've become somebody and how important it is to be somebody. And now we have this spiritual guy talking about, well, it's just as important to be nobody. So I thought to myself, well, what would be the advantage of being nobody? Well, for instance, nobody dies well. Okay, we have this pregnant pause here. And, yeah, that's sort of like next for all of us. We have this like full life and we're always somebody. And you know, have you ever listened to somebody trying to die? Wow, they're fighting every moment. They're not going to give up. It's not in their nature to surrender to the natural order of things. But you listen to somebody who's nobody? Yeah. Time to get reborn. Time to be somebody else. How cool is that? So I embraced this nobody training. And I thought to myself, when should nobody training start? And it came to me probably around 30. Now, that may sound like just an arbitrary number to you. But if you think about it, you know, like the Buddha was 29 when he left his family in the care of his parents to go out and become nobody. And Jesus became nobody around 30, and Muhammad became nobody around. I mean, all these really cool religious spiritual people at some point around 30 looked at their life and said, geez, there must be more to it than this. Is that what life's about, news, weather, and sports? You know? And all of a sudden, rather than looking outside, they started to look inside. And that's when the true nobody training starts, when you start to look inside to find out who you really are. Now, along the way, as you start to find out who you really are, you're probably going to lose friends and family. Because they're going to start to wonder who you are as well. And you may decide that you no longer want to go see the Lakers play. You'd much rather go on a retreat. And they're going to say, what the heck is wrong with you? And you can't tell them you're in nobody training, because that won't make any sense either. So you sort of have to let them go. But then there are other people who come into your life who are also in nobody training. And you find them at retreats and yoga centers and meditation centers. And it's not just the Eastern philosophy, but the Western philosophy as well. You know, I just got back from the third Monks in the West conference, which was held at the Sagely City of 10,000 Buddhas in Ukiah, California. Has anybody heard of the Sagely City of 10,000 Buddhas? It used to be the California Mental Hospital. And now it's become a Buddhist city. And the energy is about the same. It's pretty interesting. So we had this conference of 8 Catholic monks and 7 Buddhist monks came together, men, and there seems to be a difference between men and women. You know, and so it's really cool for the men to get together and share, because it's difficult sometimes. And these are monastic men. And you would think they'd be used to sharing because they live with other men all the time. They eat with them. They die with them in the back. There's a whole cemetery in the back of these monasteries. You would think they'd, but they don't like to share because it's too personal. So we shared together because then we just all left and we'll never see each other again, at least for another couple of years. And you know what one of the most interesting things of this was? We discussed midlife crisis and monastic burnout. And to a man, we all had a midlife crisis. Now, you wouldn't think Buddhist monks and Catholic monks would have a midlife crisis. You would think in their formation as a monk, in their daily routine, they would have plenty to do. The Catholics get up at like 3:30 every morning to pray. And they pray 5 times a day. And they work. And they study. You would think they'd just go to bed and be totally exhausted. Midlife crisis? No, they all had them. And one of the most interesting parts for me was listening to the Catholics. They weren't sure if it was good not to have a family and children. They felt a certain sense of loss about that because they had chosen a path of celibacy and individuality with their brothers. They lived in community. Midlife crisis. They all had it. I had one in 2001. I was 52 years old. And I wanted to know if I still had it. So you know what I did? I got on my motorcycle, and I took a 5,000-mile motorcycle ride alone without a cell phone. And I thought to myself, either I'm going to die or I'm going to come back feeling rejuvenated. Well, I came back, and I just came back feeling tired. I didn't feel rejuvenated at all. But there was something deep inside of me that needed me to do that, so I did it. And to a man, everyone else did something. Some thought about monastic burnout is the time to leave the monastery. Because they were just, one monk said, the first time I was abbot, I was too young. The second time I was abbot, I was too old. He wasn't abbot at the right time. And that's sometimes the way life works. It's just we are who we are at the wrong time. And that's why it's not working out so well. You know? So we shared a lot. It was nice to share with these men of God and the Dharma. And even though our lifestyles were similar, our end goal was much different. But we had enough to talk about to stay friends. So here we are, faced with the dilemma of turning 30 or so, and questioning our whole life up to then. And am I doing the right thing? Should I have done something else? Am I married to the right person? Should I be single? If I'm single, should I be married? If I don't have kids, should I have kids? It's endless. And there was no answer to all of this. So then the process starts, and the Buddha said, you are created by your karma and your parents having sex, and you are here not to learn any new lessons, but to end your karma. And if you are able to end your karma in this lifetime, you will never have to be reborn again. Now, that may not sound like a big deal. Oh, I ended my karma, now I don't have to be reborn again. How lucky am I? I won't exist ever again. Well, that's not exactly the case. But can you imagine how cool it would be not to be reborn again? Because you would never have to get old again. You would never have to get sick again. You would never have to die again. How many times have we done that in our evolution on this planet? Wow. So we've seen it all. We've done it all. It's never led to anything good. It just keeps giving us more suffering to deal with. And we always die in a different way. Wow. So can you imagine one day, nirvana, no karma, never to be reborn again, existing forever, not because of creation, but because of your nirvana, because of your spiritual practice. You have cheated the death guy, Mara. Cool. So here we are. Okay, so what part of me dies? Well, the part of me that dies is probably the form first. But you know what's ironic about the form dying? It doesn't care, because it doesn't know it's alive. This body just keeps doing what the mind tells it to. Sometimes, anyway. After a certain age, it doesn't do much. But until then, we're just dragging this body around. Is it ever afraid of dying? Never. Because it doesn't know. The mind, the self, the personhood, absolutely scared. Fear, dread of that moment when we'll no longer exist, not as a body, but as a self, as a personality, as an individual. So the Buddha said, form is the body, and the mind has consciousness, perception, sensation, and volition. So the consciousness is like the blank board, the blackboard with nothing written on it. Okay, so that's consciousness. Perception, we sort of understand what it is. We name it. We've got 100,000 words, 200,000 words, sometimes a couple different languages. We can name it. Okay, sensations, yeah, I know that's good, I want it. Oh, I know that's bad, I don't want it. Sensation, good sensation, bad sensation, neutral sensation. And then finally, volition. All the activity that goes into acquiring it or pushing it aside, never to be around it again. Can you imagine looking at yourself in that way and being attached to anything? It wouldn't work. You know, what part of you? You'd have the naming, you'd have the sensation, you'd have the volitional activities, the habit patterns that have been formed through this whole lifetime, maybe many lifetimes, and that's sort of it. And there you go, and you just sort of, you know, and all of a sudden, the aggregates start to fall apart, and we would call that death. But the aggregates would just be sort of falling apart. So where does this essence come from? Do we really have a unique essence? The Buddha was asked, is there a soul? He was pretty... He sort of walked around that question. He didn't go right to it. He said, well, there may be a soul, he said, but that's not who you really are. Now, Christian, Jew, and Muslim would go, geez. Not only don't you guys have a creator God, you question the idea of soul as well. So what's being reborn if you don't have a soul? Hindus would say, the soul is being reborn. The Buddhists would say, karmic energy is being reborn. Everything we've thought, said, and done in this lifetime has created an energy wake. We've transformed energy in a positive or negative way, a moral way, a skillful or unskillful way. Can't destroy energy, can't create it, but we can transform it. That energy flow, that wake that follows us, goes into the next lifetime. And it seeks out the man and the woman in those intimate moments. It knows. And it goes there. And there it becomes life. How cool is that? Okay. As we look at the problem of soul, the Buddha said, if we have a soul that's unchanging and eternal, we may decide that in one of our many lifetimes, we can just be a royal jerk. And we'll make up for it in the next five lifetimes. You know, okay, that's sort of a valid argument not to have a soul, or not to be too connected or attached to it. But he went on to say, if you don't have a soul, then it won't matter at all what you do. Because there's no consequence. When you die, you'll simply feed the trees. So he chose the middle path. He said, you may have a soul, but that's not who you really are. So now the Buddhist would sit quietly and say, well, who am I really? What is my true essence? And when you come to that place in your practice where you start to have an inclination of what your true essence might be, a sense of peace arises, a sense of equanimity, and also a great compassion. And this is the cool part that comes up in the Mahayana tradition and not so much in the Theravada tradition. Theravada tradition, it's all about wisdom, insight, clarity. Mahayana tradition, insight's okay, but you have to temper that with compassion. Because you have to be generous sometimes. You have to be kind sometimes. And if you have too much insight into the true nature, you're gonna ignore half the people in the world as just being jerks. And you know exactly why they are that way. You know? But when you have a little bit of compassion thrown in and mixed up with the insight, then they're a jerk, but you give them a break. You know, you're kind to them at least, even if you don't agree with them. So it turns out that our true nature, according to the Heart Sutra and according to the Mahayana tradition, our true nature is emptiness. That's who we really are. That's the essence, emptiness. Now, what does that mean? Emptiness, as defined in the Mahayana tradition, is empty of independent existence. That's it. It's not empty like a glass. It's empty of independent existence. The Buddha said we are all conditional creatures, and we need a lot of conditions to exist any day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We need air and water and food and shelter and medicine, clothing. We need like a lot of stuff. You know, you look at New York now with the hurricanes and stuff, and man, you know, they're just like, they don't have electricity for 10 days. It's the end of the world. And it's going to be tough because it's cold too, you know, and the water doesn't work and there's trash everywhere. How many conditions do we need to be comfortable? A lot. A lot. And you take too many conditions away, we're uncomfortable. You take enough conditions away, we're dead. Whoa. And yet somehow we're all still here. We've always had enough conditions in our life to support our life. Cool. So we are conditional creatures. We are dependent on a lot of things as well as other people for our survival. When we come to this place of emptiness in our practice and experience it personally, what we find is the interconnected and interdependent nature of life. The interconnected and interdependent nature of life. That we are always, always have been, always will be interconnected with everything all the time. All the time. We seem separate because of ego and self and the story that it's written for us. And we need to be separate because the world is a very complicated place and we need to be able to interact with it and manipulate it and use it to our advantage. And we can't do that if we are one with it, but we can do that if we're connected to it and yet independent from it. Got it. So now, if you really understand this interconnection and interdependent, would you ever eat a cheeseburger? Well, I still like cheeseburgers. And, you know, and I know I'm interdependent and interconnected. I went to Google and looked it up. 7 billion people in planet Earth right now. And I said to myself, how many animals do those 7 billion people eat each year? And they eat 140 billion animals, those 7 billion. Man, talk about life and death on this planet, huh? All the time? And maybe we could eat broccoli one day a week and asparagus and salad, dressing, vinegar and oil. Maybe, I don't know. I haven't gotten there yet, but I tell you what, the more I read and the more I understand and the more I practice, the more sense it makes that maybe I don't have to kill as many animals or have them killed for me as I used to. That maybe I can live fine and have a better figure. if I eat more vegetables and less meat. But we're interconnected and interdependent. They are us and we are them at some level. Ultimate level, not relative level, ultimate level. So our true nature is in the interconnection and interdependence. Our true nature is we are one with all and they are one with us in the sense of being connected, not being the same. We have unity and we have diversity. And when they talked about form is emptiness and emptiness is form, what they were talking about is a relative understanding of the true nature. Because you still have two. You still have form and you still have emptiness. So that was my last big problem. Okay, well, why do they put it that way? Why do they? Because the mind needs at least two to think. If the mind only has one, it becomes an intuitive knowing rather than a relative understanding. And this practice of meditation that we do is designed to exercise our intuitive knowing. As Suzuki Roshi said, Zen mind, beginner's mind, choiceless awareness. As they said in Stranger in a Strange Land, Robert Heinlein, to grok. Grok. That we have a wordless knowing simply by being aware. And we take that and create an intellectual understanding and write a story. So this practice of ours is designed to exercise that. We've lost it. Our intellect's far too big. We know far too many things that are absolutely useless. And that's why the most... I always have to tell myself that too, as I just before I speak, because I'm thinking I'm going to be using words not for another hour. And that means I don't know anything. So I have to be really humble and say these words are always fingers pointing at something, but never at the thing. So, intuitive knowing, intellectual understanding, two sides of the same coin. Emptiness, form, two sides of the same coin. The true nature of the world is the coin, but none of us can speak about the coin. We can only experience the coin. And when we speak, we have heads and tails. We have form and emptiness. We have intellect and intuition. So this is really a cool journey to go on, to go into nobody training, to define yourself as not being who you've always been, and using that to your advantage, not letting people or situations get to you because there's no one to get to. You are now able not to suffer because you are nobody rather than somebody, and only somebody suffers. Nobody ever suffers. May those of us who have come together tonight in mind and heart be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to us. May no difficulties come to us. May no problems come to us. May we always find fulfillment. May we also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May our parents, our partners, our pets, brothers and sisters, friends and family, all the people we don't know, all the people we don't like, may they too be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to them. May no difficulties come to them. May no problems come to them. May they always find fulfillment. May they also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. By the power of truth found in the teachings of the Buddhas, may all misfortunes due to stars, demons, harmful spirits, and ominous planets be prevented and destroyed. May the rain fall in due time. May there be a rich harvest. May the world be prosperous. May the governments be righteous. With the powers of all the fully awakened Buddhas, with the powers of all the fully awakened Bodhisattvas, may those of us sitting here tonight be secure and protected in every way. Okay, I brought my ukulele tonight to have a little entertainment. I'm not going to do Kumbaya, though, tonight. But maybe another night. And I just put on some new strings, so we'll have to just tune it up a bit here.
How many do you have?
How many do I have? I think I've got 6 now. You can't have just one ukulele. Even as a monk, well, I've had to get rid of a few, so I'm left with 6, and but only attached to 2 of them. You know. I'm sorry. Oh, you thought it was a little machine gun?
Oh, that'd be great.
Well, yeah. I didn't see that movie, but I bet they probably do carry something like that. So I went on YouTube to find all the Buddhist ukulele songs I could find. And unfortunately, I didn't find any. So I said to myself, well, maybe I should just sort of make some up. And so the first ukulele song I did was I found this Christian song. And I figured they wouldn't mind. And I just changed a few words. And so now we have a Christian Buddhist song played on a ukulele. And it goes like this. Spin well, sweet Dharma wheel, coming for to wake me up. Spin well, sweet Dharma wheel, coming for to wake me up. Well, I sat down to meditate, and what did I see? Coming for to wake me up. Coming for to wake me up. Spin well, sweet Dharma wheel. Coming for to wake me up. Spin well, sweet Dharma wheel. Coming for to wake me up. Well, if you wake up before I do, coming for to wake me up. Tell my friends that I'm awakened too. Coming for to wake me up. Spin well, sweet Dharma wheel. Coming for to wake me up. Spin well, sweet Dharma wheel. Coming for to wake me up. Coming for to wake me up. All right. Thank you, thank you. For my next selection, I found this song on YouTube, and it was initially written by an ex-Catholic monk. And I liked the edge it had, but I didn't like all the words he used, so I changed some of the words, I changed the key that it was sung in, and I added some chords. So it sort of became mine after a while. Now, I've had the privilege of being able to sing this song in a couple churches that I gave a talk at, and it just didn't go over very well at all. So I figured a Buddhist group would probably be the best to sing the song to, though I must admit I was at a Catholic all-girls school just a few weeks ago, and I sang this song there, and when I reached the chorus, I said, "Okay, everybody..." And when you hear the words to the song, there was shock and disillusionment on their face when I wanted them to join in. But so this song is called Jesus Doesn't Want Me and the Devil Don't Care. And it sort of goes like this. Jesus doesn't want me and the devil, well, he don't care. God is in his heaven and the Holy Spirit's out there somewhere. Buddha just sits, oh, he smiles so kindly. I just figured it out and finally, Jesus doesn't want me and the devil, well, he don't care. Jesus wants to save my soul, Satan wants it too. Devil and an angel sitting on his shoulder, telling me just what to do. The one on the left says, do the right thing. One on the other says, to hell with him. How am I to know which one to do? Ah, Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, well, he don't care. God is in his heaven, and the Holy Spirit's out there somewhere. Buddha just sits, oh, he smiles so kindly. I just figured it out, and finally, Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, well, he don't care. All my life I've tried my best to win and never lose, but no one sits on shoulders. I've always had to choose. When I found the Buddha way, I lost all fearful thought. With mind so still, heart so full, never to get caught. Now I know which way I am to choose. Ah, Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, well, he don't care. God is in his heaven, and the Holy Spirit's out there somewhere. Buddha just sits, oh, he smiles so kindly. I just figured it out, and finally, Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, well, he don't care. Thank you. I like that song.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.